Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This week, we bring you two of our favorite Media Minute stories from the past year.
Yeah, hey, it's Bob.
Great As work. President and CEO of Clergy work, Strategic Alliances, Reverend Ramal Toon travels the country training churches on voter registration, issue education, and how to build justice ministries through effective national and local coalitions. Reverend Toon brought his message of collaboration and unity to the National Conference for Media Reform in Minneapolis. We can achieve far more through unity, he says, than we can ever achieve on our own.
Unity. Unity allows us to accept that even though we come from different places, have different agendas, different goals, and different ways to bring about change, all of us are trying to get to a similar place that makes life better for the people we serve. Unity. Unity allows us to say that even though there are times when we may not agree, we are still on the same side, and I will stand with you in the fight to achieve our dreams, because the greatest gift we have in the pursuit of change is each other. You see, obstacles are the things you see when you take your eyes off your goals. And whenever we find ourselves debating over which organization's logo was not included on a flyer, whenever we find ourselves engaging in the politics of this organization getting more money than that organization, whenever we find ourselves arguing over the speaking order at a press conference, we must be mindful of the harsh reality that tonight across this country, there are children who will sleep on city streets. Every 3 hours, a child will die through to gun violence. Families will struggle to put food on the table. And these are the people who are waiting for us to show up and demand power for the powerless. They are the reason. They are the reason why failure is not an option. Somebody say unity.
To listen to Reverend Ramal Toon's entire speech and others from the National Conference for Media Reform, go to freepress.net/conference.
And now, a commentary by Free Press blogger Megan Tatey.
My dad called me recently from his home in Oklahoma City, aghast. I'd been telling him about the problem of the digital divide, but it's hard for him to understand when he can jump online in a matter of seconds. But something he heard on local radio stunned him. A woman called in and told the hosts she didn't have internet access where she lived outside the city. She was hoping to get more information about Republican presidential candidate John McCain. According to my dad, she said, "Now I hear John McCain was in a war. Does that mean he's going to be a war president?" Sure, you don't need the internet to learn the basics of McCain's biography. But tens of millions of Americans do not have the equal ability to educate themselves about this crucial election. Half of the population can easily access newspapers and magazines from across the country and around the world to find a variety of opinions about the candidates. They can watch videos of stump speeches, read a blog post about the merits of a candidate's stance on an issue, or do their own investigation into campaign contributions. The other half must rely on what the mainstream media decide to offer viewers and readers for political coverage. The digital divide isn't just about relegating people to slow email. It's about thwarting people's civic engagement, preempting their cultural participation, and ultimately stifling democratic action. Presidential contenders Barack Obama and John McCain have been debating on national TV. Viewers with broadband don't have to rely on just the moderators and pundits. They can use their internet connection to research the facts and the fiction. But once again, the other half of the population will be hamstrung, only able to get the spin they are being fed by the networks. The next president must adopt policy that rolls out open, affordable, high-speed internet access to all Americans. It is essential that every American has equal and open access to the internet in order to fully participate in elections and in our democracy. Here's a first step. Perhaps one of the debate moderators could ask the next president, how will you bring a universal, affordable broadband to all Americans?
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're fortunate and privileged to have as our guest. A returning guest has been with us twice before on the program. He joins us today to discuss his brand new book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Our guest, Andrew J. Basevich, is professor of history and international relations at Boston University, former colonel in the U.S. military, and graduate of West Point. Professor Basevich, it's a great honor to welcome you to our program today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You know, I had the pleasure of reading your book this weekend, having read your other books, and I was very pleasantly surprised that you've really taken this, I think, in a new direction from a lot of your two previous books that I'd read. And I was wondering if you could just give a brief synopsis of the point of the book and the argument of the book suggested by your title, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism.
I'm chewing on your opening remark because to my mind, I didn't think I was going in a different direction, but rather just continuing in the direction I'd been headed.
No, actually, I agree. You were continuing it, but what was nice about it, I think, was there was value added, I guess is the point I was trying to make.
Well, I think the essence of the argument I'm making is this. I've been struck for quite some time. But what I see as a tendency on the part of Americans generally and certainly our politicians more narrowly to think that the solution to the problems that ail us here at home somehow are to be found abroad, that through sufficiently sustained exertions we can arrange the world in ways that will sustain the American way of life at home. And my belief is that that's an illusion, that the antidote to problems that ail us here at home have to be found here at home, and that only if we acknowledge the necessity to live within our means, which implies enormous changes both in the way we run the country but also in our own culture, only then can we get ourselves out of the predicament in which we find ourselves. The belief that the solution to our problems lies abroad is a belief that stems from a wildly overinflated estimate of American power and especially American military power. One of the things that's become crystal clear since the beginning of the global war on terror is that American power and especially American military power are quite limited. So I think we need to look within. I think we need to clean up our own act, and only then will we be able to ensure our security, restore our prosperity, and I think also really preserve our democracy.
Professor Basevich, how much does the current economic or financial crisis the United States is in tie into the argument you're making? Although the book came out shortly before the excrement hit the fan, do you think that it really follows from your argument?
Well, you're right. The book first began to appear in August, and it was several weeks later that the collapse of the economy really began. I believe that the economic crisis, in many respects, validates the argument in the book. I mean, to the extent that I argue quite explicitly in the book that we cannot continue to live beyond our means, it seems to me that the collapse of the market and the grave distress being felt by many people across the country is a reflection of that.
You know, one of the striking features of your work, Professor Bacevich, not just this book, but the other books as well, is that you put the current situation in historical context, and you, I think, make it evident that U.S. foreign policy of the Bush years is not anomalous to the tradition of recent generations or even to all of American history. There's a broader pattern here. And I think you're making that argument in this book with regard to our economics as well. But as I listened to your comments just now, I'm wondering, is there in your mind a capitalism in America that can be the sort of capitalism that you're talking about? Because it seems so foreign to the type of capitalism we've had for generations.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm old enough now and jaded enough to have concluded that there's no perfect system of political economy, that regardless of what system we would embrace, there would be ups and downs and problems. I do believe that one of the great lessons of the 20th century, where there were many experiments launched with state-directed economies, centralized economies, central planning, I do believe that the lesson of history is that the market is far and away the most effective mechanism when it comes to generating wealth. That said, it's also crystal clear, and the current economic crisis emphasizes this, the market itself can be dangerous, and therefore the market does need to be regulated. Government does need to play an active and continuing role in trying to prevent the market from causing unnecessary harm. So I still believe that capitalism is a superior system to any of the alternatives. But I'm very conscious of the fact that capitalism also is a deeply flawed system.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Professor Andrew J. Bacevich from Boston University, author of numerous books. We're talking about his new book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, just published by Metropolitan Books a few months ago. If you'd like to join us with a question or comment for the professor, the number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We welcome your calls. In this book, Professor Bacevich, you mention frequently, in fact, your recurring theme is sort of a central muse almost for your argument, is a theologian from 20th century American history who I read in graduate school a great deal, so it was a pleasure to see you resurrect him, Reinhold Niebuhr. And he plays, I think, a central role in your critique. Can you talk a little about who Niebuhr is and why you rely upon him and draw from him?
Yes. I happen to be a Catholic. Niebuhr is a Protestant theologian who, in his heyday in the 30s, 40s, 50s, even into the 1960s, was one of the probably five or six most important public intellectuals in this country. And I stumbled upon him, I guess, a handful of years ago and had begun to use one of his books called The Irony of American History in a course I teach. And as I've taught that book each year, it became clearer and clearer to me that it really is the most important critique, I think, of U.S. foreign policy ever written. Again, emphasizing this is a book by a Protestant theologian. And I guess what strikes me as especially important about Niebuhr, and I mean especially important for us today, would be his insistence that we not engage or only engage at our own peril in entertaining a mythic sort of story of America's role in the world. Niebuhr was a realist. A realist in the sense that he believed that all nation states, that no nation state can be altruistic, that all of them are motivated by self-interest and considerations of power. And he was insistent that the United States is not somehow exempt from that rule. So whereas many Americans, most Americans, certainly the sort of the 19-year-olds who come into my classroom at BU have this, entertain this narrative of U.S. history in which we were an isolationist country that just wished to be left alone until World War II, when we were somewhat reluctantly summoned to assume a position of global leadership. The fact of the matter is, and I argue with this in my book, but it's also very much inherent in Niebuhr's writing, we became a great power because we sought power. The United States has, from the very outset, been an expansionist country. And in many respects, expansionism served us well, making us more powerful and more prosperous, and probably making it possible for our political system to bring more and more citizens into the circle of freedom. But that tendency of expansionism to facilitate prosperity and freedom, I think, is broken down in our own day. And what we need to do is to recognize that the old expansionist tradition has outlived its usefulness, and we need to fundamentally, therefore, rethink what are the premises of U.S. foreign policy. And if I could just continue for briefly.
Yes, please do.
It seems to me that the proper way to understand President Bush's global war on terror, which certainly is intended to prevent the recurrence of 9/11, the proper way to attach the global war on terror to our earlier history is to see it as yet a further effort at expansionism, that the United States is attempting to, you know, pick your word, liberate, pacify, dominate the greater Middle East. And this is very much consistent with the tradition of U.S. efforts in other parts of the world in earlier days. But what we're finding this time out, because our power is so limited, the effort to liberate or pacify or dominate the greater Middle East is failing, and in the course of failing, it's also bankrupting the country.
You know, one of the themes that comes through in The Limits of Power, Professor Bacevich, or one of the arguments you make that you just said, is that our nation needs to come to grips with these the nature of our, I guess for lack of a better term, imperial or military project around the world, and the limitations of it, and the problems with it, and address it directly. Yet, as you point out in the book, it seems this tendency towards the military and empire is so deeply woven into our mythology and our political system and our institutions that for politicians to raise this issue is almost to commit suicide. I mean, there's tremendous pressure upon all politicians to sort of pay heed. Am I accurately reflecting what you write in the book, or?
No, I think you're putting your finger on what is a very important issue here, and it really is an obstacle to finding a solution, and that is that the language that we use to discuss our role in the world is misleading. It's false. It's self-congratulatory. You know, I do use words like empire and imperial in this book, and as I have in other books. And I'm not the only person writing about U.S. foreign policy who uses that kind of language. But I think in the political arena, those words are still radioactive. You're quite right. For a politician who aspires to national office to stand up and make a speech that says, it's past time for us to take a second look at the American empire and to consider whether or not maintaining that empire serves the interests of the American people, using that kind of language would almost immediately disqualify him would make him non-competitive in the race. And yet it's only when we acknowledge the extent that we have become an empire, an informal empire we have, not a formal one, it's only when we acknowledge that having a military that has a global presence reflects not the fact that our motives have been defensive, but that our ambitions are far more aggressive. It's only when we're sort of willing to acknowledge those things that we can then have a serious conversation about how much change is necessary or how many of the old routines and practices ought to be preserved because they may serve our interests. So there's a dishonesty, I think, that has crept into the way we talk about foreign policy that really is an impediment to bringing about change.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Andrew J. Basevich, professor at Boston University of History and International Relations, author of numerous books, including the brand new book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, published by Metropolitan Books, came out in August of this year. And we're talking about that book here on Media Matters. The phone number is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We're live today, so we'd welcome your calls this final Sunday of 2008. And just to follow up and finish on that last point you were making, Professor Basevich, what role does, do you think, and this isn't a major part of your book, it's not even a part at all, you just allude to it a few points, what role, though, does the news media play in sort of disciplining discourse to sort of keep it within the mythology or to keep it within the boundaries where the institutions aren't examined?
Well, I think that there, I haven't thought deeply about this. I'm certainly one who is as critical as many others have been about the media's reporting in the period leading up to the invasion of the Iraq War. It certainly failed to ask any serious questions about the case that was being made for the invasion. I personally think that the media coverage of the war, once things began to go badly, improved tremendously, and that by and large we began to get a much clearer picture of the reality in Iraq. Having said that, I think that most reporting by the media is kind of framed in a way that fails to take issue with the mythic portrayal of U.S. foreign policy, that doesn't really pose the deeper questions about U.S. motivation, doesn't want to connect the dots between domestic interests and foreign policy interventionism. And so in that sense, I think the media doesn't do an especially good job. I'm not sure they do. Their performance in that regard is worse in the area of foreign policy as opposed to any other area of public life, but it could be improved.
Our guest, Andrew Basevich, author of The Limits of Power. And Professor Basevich, you write in this book a lot about the politics of empire. And one of the points you make that I thought was interesting was that in general, and this follows up on the discussion we've been having, we shouldn't expect too much difference between Republicans and Democrats. Not that there aren't tangible differences. And you gave the example of the 2006 congressional elections when the Democrats won a historically enormous landslide in the U.S. House of Representatives and even in the Senate. And the general consensus was that this was a vote against the war in Iraq, yet it really didn't change anything in Iraq. Once the Democrats got in power, they didn't really want to go to the mattresses, so to speak, to force the war to end. What was your point when you talked about that in the book, and what does it mean for your argument?
Well, I've felt for some time that the continuities in our politics from one administration to the next are much more revealing than the discontinuities, and that the similarities between Republicans and Democrats are actually much more important than the differences between them in terms of really understanding what's going on. And here I have to say, to refer back to the last question, I think this is something where the media's shortcomings are quite evident. I mean, if you listen to Republicans and Democrats talk about the other party always represents the forces of darkness. And it seems to me that the media tends to report those kinds of charges with pretty much a straight face, and therefore lends them credibility. And to accept that kind of stuff with a straight face is, I think, to miss those critically important continuities. And I think one of the important continuities and one of the important similarities between Republicans and Democrats is that both parties place an exaggerated emphasis on military power. And both parties seem to believe that if we can retain our claim to being the world's sole superpower in a military sense, that that can somehow obviate problems that exist in other realms, whether we're talking about energy dependence or we're talking about trade imbalances, low savings rates, persistent federal deficits, a whole host of other problems that it seems to me are urgently important, and where military power as a practical matter is not going to make much of a difference.
Our guest today, Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power, professor of history at Boston University. Please call to join us if you'd like at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. When reading The Limits of Power this weekend, Professor Bacevich, I was struck by your discussion of Afghanistan. And as I read it and about the Soviet troops and then the American troops going in and almost in a way replacing them in the minds of the Afghanis, not seeing them as fundamentally that different. I was thought of the saying, someone once told me that Afghanistan's nickname was where empires go to die. And I was wondering, were President-elect Obama to call you or Secretary of State-designate Clinton were to call you and ask for your assessment of Afghanistan and what the appropriate policy would be for the United States going forward, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say don't be too quick to fulfill Obama's campaign pledge to send more U.S. troops there. I am very skeptical that that alone can provide anything close to a fix to the problem we have. My own assessment would begin with, well, I'm definitely not an expert in Afghan history, but from what I know of Afghan history, it seems to me that the Afghan political tradition is one in which effective governance has never been exercised from Kabul across the entire country. That as a practical matter, political authority rests in the hands of warlords or tribal chieftains or whatever you want to call them, but local authorities. It's been a very decentralized political system. What we've been trying to do since 2001 is to impose a modern, cohesive model of governance on that geographic expression. And it hasn't gone well. I mean, one could argue that it hasn't gone well in part because we've been so distracted with Iraq, but the fact of the matter is it hasn't gone well. And I'm doubtful that simply trying harder, you know, sending in more U.S. troops, spending more money, which we don't have, is going to make a difference. I would urge some consideration be given to playing along with that system or that tradition of political decentralization. In essence, let's outsource the effort to bring security to Afghanistan to those tribal chieftains who are the traditional sources of authority. And as long as they don't permit Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-like organizations to take up residence in the area that these tribal chieftains control, quite frankly, I don't think we have any significant interests in Afghanistan that we have to pursue. As long as the place is not a den of terrorist activity, frankly, don't think we care all that much about Afghanistan. Frankly, don't think we have much of an ability to affect things that go on in Afghanistan. So I think I'd want to at least examine that option.
And if we could turn then also to Iraq, which of course has been sort of the main war the United States has been fighting of our wars of the past decade. And your take on the situation there today, and if I could ask you, it's not exactly in the book, but it's implied in the book, how you think historians are going to be looking back at the Iraq War and its role in American history?
Well, I think they're going to see it as a fool's errand. I mean, my understanding of, I mean, there's a huge amount of confusion, and there's a significant debate, I think, over why exactly the Bush administration invaded Iraq in the first place. The extent to which it was done because they believed that there were weapons of mass destruction, or because they wanted to grab the oil, or because they wanted to protect Israel. I mean, there's a whole variety of arguments that are made. I personally believe that the most important rationale for invading Iraq was that people within the Bush administration who were committed to a strategy of trying to fundamentally transform the Islamic world believed that Iraq was the best place to begin this project. They believed that transforming Iraq, making it a modern, quasi-democratic, stable nation-state would be a relatively easy project. And they thought that by showing that the United States could and would bring about that kind of change in Iraq, it would therefore become easier to accomplish change elsewhere in the Islamic world. It turned out that the architects of this war miscalculated in a tragic way. The war turned out to be not easy but hard, not short but long, not cheap but costly. And I myself would be very skeptical that we're going to get a modern, stable, quasi-democratic Iraq anytime in the near future, and therefore the historical judgment of Iraq, to my mind, will be one in which this misguided and unnecessary war serves only to demonstrate the strategic folly of the Bush administration as they tried to figure out what would be the most appropriate response to 9/11. They went down the wrong path, and Iraq is really the demonstration of that.
Professor Bacevich, in the book, you're making an argument, as you just did, for a rethinking of the U.S. role in the world and sort of the limits of power, as the book is titled. You know, the U.S. currently spends, I think, and I don't know the exact figure, roughly $600 or $650 billion a year on the military.
It's probably closer to $800 billion, but yeah.
$800 billion. And I think if you factor in interest on debt taken to pay for military in past years, you can get the figure even higher.
Yeah.
And by many calculations, we're approximately half of global military spending in the
That's
United
correct.
States. It's, you know, we're really at a full war economy, in other words, it's a level of spending of our economy pretty much, or close to it. And, you know, in a sane world, in the world you'd like to see, in the sort of country you'd like to live in, what sort of amount of military spending do you think would be appropriate for a society like ours?
Well, I don't know that I can give a good answer to that question. I mean, I think I'd come at it, the question I think I'd want to ask is, what is military power good for? When should it be used? And given the world in which we live, what kind of military, therefore, should we pay for? And if you work your way through that sequence of questions, you'll end up getting, at the end of the line, there'll be some numbers that will equal a defense budget.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it would be much less than what we're currently spending. But again, to sort of back up in a sense, We really have, as a nation, come to believe that the projection of military power on a global basis is a particular strong suit for the country. We persuaded ourselves after the Cold War, and particularly after Operation Desert Storm, that military power, as employed by the United States, high-tech weapons, very professional, well-trained soldiers. We persuaded ourselves that military power had become, as never before in history, really an effective instrument for solving problems. And this was not just, you know, sort of crazies on the right who were arguing this. It was crazies on the left. I mean, the people who became proponents of humanitarian interventionism. Let's use the American military to sort of go fix the bad things that happen around the world. All of this, it seems to me, reflected a grotesque misunderstanding of war and of the very real limits, I think, on the utility of force. So we ought to have a good military. We ought to have a strong military, but we ought to see force as something that's used as a last resort. We ought to see force as something that should be employed for defensive purposes, not to go out and fix the world's problems or reorder the world to suit our preferences. We ought to be very wary of the tendency of wars to go awry, to bring about unintended and frequently very costly second-order consequences. And so we ought to become more modest, I think, in our understanding of what role military power should play in U.S. foreign policy. Again, whether that leads us spending $400 billion a year or $300 billion a year, I don't know off the top of my head, but it certainly causes us to have a lower military profile than we have had for the past 60 or so years.
You cite C. Wright Mills favorably, his legendary, his great book, The Power Elite, in your book, The Limits of Power, Professor Bacevich. And the reason I raised that issue about military spending, among others, is that it's striking to me as I read your book how in political debate, presidential candidates in particular that come to mind, you know, it's absolutely impossible to even hint at a reduction in military spending. I mean, Democrat or Republican, it's always about who's going to raise the ante the most, at least in public debate. And it's sort of a striking feature. And I wonder how much of that is driven by the fact that there are enormous industries also that benefit by military spending.
Well, I certainly acknowledge the fact that there is a military-industrial complex and it's got clout. I tend not to see the military-industrial complex as the primary explanation for that consensus that you just described.
Mm-hmm.
I think that other explanations that at least ought to be sort of added into the pot. One would be that there has come into existence in Washington over the last 40 years really a powerful national security apparatus, the apparatus of the national security state. There are people who have powerful institutional interests and career interests in maintaining this emphasis on military power, and they have a certain amount of clout in both parties. But I think there's also whether it's real or it's self-imposed, I don't know, but liberal Democrats persuading themselves that if they look soft on national security for a millisecond, that their political chances are going to go down the tube, and therefore we have this inclination of liberal Democrats to chest thump when it comes to national security issues as much or more as supposedly more hawkish Republicans. I mean, remember the remark during the campaign, I think it was Senator Clinton who talked about vaporizing Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it would be, I think, again, this goes back to the lack of really of issues to differentiate Republicans and Democrats. It actually would be very good if we could have a hawkish party and a dovish party. In other words, a party that mm-hmm. was consistently arguing from a principled position for why we should place less emphasis on military power and have that debated out as part of our politics. But we don't have a hawkish party and a dovish party. We have two hawkish parties. And I think that that, much more than the military-industrial complex, it may explain why, you know, as you mentioned earlier, we spend as much money on the military as the rest of the world put together, which when you say it out loud, it's an astonishing fact. And yet the truth is, it's not controversial. Oh, of course, yes, we spend as much money on our military as the rest of the world put together. Okay.
And we're the peace-loving people. Our guest today, Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, and a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, thank you for your patience in Champaign. You're on the air with Professor Bacevich. Hello, line one. Apparently we've lost line one.
I regret this.
Oh, okay. Please go ahead.
Okay, good. That's better. First, thanks for speaking. I look forward to reading your book. I offer two questions. One is about reparations. So a lot of people in the peace movement, including me, think that we should be preparing to offer reparations to Iraq and to Afghanistan, as well as getting out. But it's a big question as to whether the peace movement should be concerned with how that should work, because it's tempting to say a lot of the rhetoric is, you know, we should get out and end our entanglements. There was an interesting suggestion from Stephen Kinzer recently. I don't know whether whimsical or serious, that in Afghanistan, if we spent a tenth of our annual military budget, we could buy their entire opium crop for. So it's an interesting scheme, at least an out of the box one. So how if at all, should we talk about providing reparations? The other is, there was a recent, I guess, National Intelligence Council report predicting the loss of dominance, of world dominance of the U.S. by 2025. And I'm happy to hear that prediction, but I'm worried that we may well use that as an excuse to being even more militaristic in the hopes of extending our term a bit longer, and wondered what you thought of that. Anyhow, thank you.
Thank you very much for those excellent questions, caller. And Professor Bacevich, before you answer the first one on reparations, perhaps you could give to our listeners a brief explanation of the role of reparations in the termination of wars.
Oh, I don't know that I can.
Okay. Is there an international law or custom or diplomatic tradition in terms of reparations?
Well, you're opening up a complicated subject by which I have to say I know very little. Reparations, my own understanding of history is that reparations are typically imposed by the victorious power on the defeated power. I mean, mm-hmm. The classic example would be the Allies imposing a large reparations bill on Germany. Mm-hmm. After World War I, there was interest in doing that again after World War II. The Soviets actually followed up on that. The Western Allies chose not to impose reparations on Germany, preferring instead to facilitate its rehabilitation. But again, that's what the winner does to the loser.
Yeah,
I am not familiar with a nation, in our circumstances, in a sense, paying reparations because we sort of felt bad, which I think was what the caller, or have a moral responsibility, and voluntarily choosing to pay reparations to try to acquit that moral responsibility. That may have happened sometime in history, but off the top of my head, I can't think of an example.
That's precisely what I was looking for from you, to get a sense of
that. I have to say, in this particular circumstance, I can't imagine that there would be any political traction for that in this country. I mean, whatever peace activists may wish to see happen, it's inconceivable that the Congress, regardless of which party would be be controlling it, would want to appropriate reparations to be given either to Afghanistan or Iraq at this stage of the game. And frankly, the economic crisis that we're in makes it even more implausible that would happen. So it may be an interesting thing to talk about, and from a moral perspective, it probably is an important thing to talk about, but I think politically, it's simply not going to happen. I don't know about this national intelligence report that says that by 2025, the United States is not going to be a dominant nation. Probably have an argument here about what dominant means. My own guess would be that 2025 is only about a decade and a half from now, that we will still be the most important and most powerful country in the world, and that will probably continue to be the case for decades beyond that. But what has already changed is that the notion that the United States is the sole superpower, or to use the phrase that Charles Krauthammer invented, that we live in a unipolar moment, that sort of notion of the United States as a singular nation presiding over the world, that's already been demolished. And that kind of idea, which was pernicious in the first place, has, I think, decisively been dispatched, both by the difficulties we've had in Iraq and by the economic complications that we find ourselves in. So we're going to still be very powerful, very important, but we're going to have to learn to play nice with others.
Professor Basevich, Chalmers Johnson, who graciously writes a nice endorsement of your book on the back cover and has been a guest on this program several times to discuss his work, you know, has a very gloomy projection answering that exact same question, where he sees, you know, his goal would be for the United States to emulate the British Empire, as he put it, and sort of have a soft landing and a transition to a post-imperial world. But he fears that the internal forces, politically, the United States, and the institutional forces that benefit by the status quo are so great to make that, in his really frank and morbid view, virtually impossible. Do you share that morbidness, or are you more optimistic?
Well, you know, the Brits didn't have a soft landing. I mean, the Brits, I think, had a catastrophic. The disintegration of the British Empire happened very quickly, and in many respects was a very painful process. The Brits did it to themselves in some respects, in particular because of the consequences of World War One. So, and you know, if you think, as stupid as the Iraq War is, as misguided as the global war on terror is, it really pales in comparison to the mistakes that the European powers made in World War II, especially the war of 1914-1918. So one hesitates to be in the business of, you know, predicting what's going to happen over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. But it doesn't seem to me that an American decline has to be as precipitous as the British experienced in the, you know, first half of the, or first two-thirds of the 20th century.
Well, you know, I think, in fairness, I don't think I did justice to Professor Johnson's argument. I think he was actually being quite candid in the survival of effective constitutional rule. I mean, he was, which the Brits did maintain.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't mean to contradict what I just said. As painful as shedding the empire was, it seems to me one could make the case that for the average citizen of the United Kingdom, life is actually better today than it was when, you know, Britannia ruled the world. That shedding empire actually can be a good thing. That one can retain freedom, one can still enjoy prosperity, and that empire can perhaps be an impediment to having a nation state that is well run and run in the interests of the people.
our guest, Professor Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. I'm going to get to both of them starting right now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Professor Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power.
Thank you. I really appreciate your perspective and vision on the whole area you're discussing. And going back to the matter of reparations, we're now seeing reparations burden upon the taxpayers to bail out the major economic powers, financial as well as automobile and so forth, due to the lack of vision on the parts of those who have not taken into matter the amount of regulations and runaway things that have occurred that have suddenly undermined our economic position. Going back to the Second World War, we shortly became the super economic power of the world. And overnight, we've seen it dissipate, bringing down other parts of the world also. But when we have this matter of plans presented, there was an engineer and architect presented his plans for automobile efficiency, economy, mileage, and all that to the Detroit automotive world. And they turned them down and said, we're not interested in efficiency, cars that maintain themselves for 100,000 miles. We're interested in selling cars, and the bread and butter of selling parts, so they wear out. So he presented, Japan picked up his plans, and we saw how they grabbed the plans that became the groundwork for the Toyota, Honda, Civic, Lexus, and all the cars that they have, and took away the great marketplace for the automobile in the world. And then we have, that was the architect, engineer, and Deming. You may have heard of him.
Can I ask you to tie this up so we can get to our other comments?
Well, but this talks about the fact that underlying all our economic condition is the fact that we did not know until recently that, as revealed by Secretary of State Baker, in order to maintain our, we must maintain our access to oil. We have a foreign policy that states we will go to war in order to maintain our access to war, to power. And so with those things in mind, we see what we're dealing with, you know. Okay, thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Do you have any comment on that, Professor Bacevich?
I mean, the caller said a lot. I'm not sure I can sort of address all the points. I do think he was touching on something very important when he made reference to the fact that, you know, 60 or so years ago, we made the stuff and the world bought it. Today, we live in an age in which it's commonly accepted that consumption really is what drives our economy. You know, they make it. They, increasingly, nations like China, we buy it. But we're buying more than we can afford. And this transition of the economy from an economy of production into an economy of consumption is, in many respects, one of those aspects of our problem that I think we haven't fully faced up to. I'm struck by the amount of conversation with regard to the stimulus package that sees the solution to our problem in the restoration of consumption. My own sense is that may be a short-term fix, but simply stimulating consumption does not provide a long-term solution to our economic crisis.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller now. Urbana, line 1, you're on the air with Professor Andrew Bacevich.
Yes, in regard to the report that came out, I think about 2 months ago, it was largely premised on the growth of the Chinese and Indian economies, which they projected would equal or be greater than our own by, I'm not sure if it was 2025, 2030, whatever, but relatively recent, short period, and that they would have greater influence due to the size of their economies than the United States would have, and that our military, I think the corollary to that is that the military supremacy we may have now would be very difficult to maintain, and perhaps not much of use. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Professor Bacevich, any comments on that?
Sure. No question about it. the emergence of China and India as great powers is likely to be one of the formative realities of the 21st century. But even if the overall size of their economies surpasses ours in 15 or 20 years, it doesn't follow that in all measures of power, we would have fallen behind them. It seems to me that we need to be sensitive to the challenges that the Chinese and the Indians have. There are environmental challenges that are massive. There are demographic challenges. Even with all the economic growth in both of those countries, there's still massive poverty. And all of these issues are going to consume a tremendous amount of energy on the part of the government of those two countries. And so the notion that just because their GDP may be larger than ours, that they're going to therefore be co-equal competitors for world power seems to me to be off the mark.
You know, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I don't know if you can do justice to this question in that time, but I'll ask you and let you see what you can do. A theme in your book that comes up at numerous points is the Selective Service, the draft, which was ended in the United States in the early 1970s. I was wondering if you could give your opinion on whether you think we should reinstate the draft or if we should not, and what your sense on that issue is today.
Yeah, I fully understand the arguments in favor of conscription. And there's an argument for people who think the global war on terror is a good thing that says that would let us have a bigger army. We need a bigger army to prosecute this war for the next 50 years.
And then there's the liberal argument that if everybody had to go to war, we wouldn't go to war very often.
Exactly right. There's the anti-war argument that says that if the population had a stake, a direct personal stake in the war, that anti-war sentiment would be translated into something that was politically effective. So I understand the argument. And in many respects, I'm sympathetic, especially to that second expression of the argument. But it's kind of like reparations. It ain't going to happen. It's not going to happen because the vast majority of, not only the vast majority of 18 and 19-year-olds don't want conscription to get passed, but my own sense is the vast majority of the parents of the 18s and 19-year-olds would oppose this. So Congress is not going to act on it. I have to say also, you know, the generals don't want it. When President Nixon ended the draft toward the end of the Vietnam War, he did so over the objections of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because the Joint Chiefs at that point felt that they would not be able to find enough volunteers to fill the force. Over the past 30 years, the officer corps has really become enamored with the notion of a professional military.
You know, Professor Basevich, I'm glad you got that last point in, because the band's tuning up. That means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, Andrew Basevich, author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Thank you for joining us. I'm Bob McChesney. I'd like to thank Bob Naiman for being my sit-in producer today. I'll be back in 167 hours. Everyone have a great new year. I'll see you in 2009.
With support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners, or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.